This is Sam Robson, here today with Crystal Frazier. Today's date is March 22nd, 2016, and we're in the audio recording suite here at CDC's Roybal campus in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm interviewing Crystal as part of the Ebola Responders Oral History Project, and we'll be discussing her life and career, and especially her work supporting the Ebola response of the 2014 epidemic. So, Crystal, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And for the record, could you please state your full name and current position with CDC?
I am Crystal Lynn Frazier, and I'm a health scientist currently.
Great.
However, by education, I'm a clinical psychologist.
Ooh, we'll get into that. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Camden, New Jersey. It's actually South Jersey. People usually are familiar with Atlantic City, that area.
And when?
In 1960.
Okay.
Is that important?
We can take it out, too.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. In 1960.
Yes. And is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Camden until I was about 10, and then my family moved. We moved to the suburbs, so Camden is a city. And we moved to the suburbs when I was 10. So.
You were 10, okay.
Yeah, the majority of the time I spent in the suburbs,
right.
I think.
Well, tell me about growing up first in Camden and then in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Camden in the 60s and in the 70s was, where I lived was called Parkside. It was a sort of a low middle income type area then. I grew up and I have three siblings, and I grew up with my parents and my siblings and family around, cousins and aunts and uncles, and that kind of thing. And it was a good time. We were able to play outside. You know, no one had to watch us every minute when we came in, when the street lights came on, you know, that kind of thing. It was good. But the city started changing, so my parents decided we probably should move, and that's what we did.
Well, how did it start changing?
So, different elements coming into the neighborhood, we decided to move out.
Right.
I was a little bit sad when we moved. Lost a lot of my friends, all that kind of thing. So,
But... And then what was it like in the suburbs?
And I say the suburbs, but actually it was the country then. It wasn't built up much at all. And it was a mixed community, primarily Caucasian. So that was new to me. I mean, in Camden, it was primarily African American. But it was good. We were welcomed. I had lots of friends in high school. I was actually the first Black homecoming queen in high school, which was kind of cool. I played sports. I played, ran track, played basketball, and I had a good time. I was pretty popular in high school, so looking back on it, probably didn't study as much as I could. I wasn't pushed, per se, academically. I mean, I had to complete my work and complete my homework and that kind of thing, but I wasn't really pushed, which I regret a little bit, but, you know, that's okay, so... But it was good. I finished. Good. Still in touch with some friends from high school to this day. So,
what did your parents do?
My dad was a field engineer for IBM, one of the first minorities in that area in New Jersey, in South Jersey anyway. And my mother was a stay-at-home mother, which was great for us. We had dinner as a family on most nights. Don't really do that anymore. I don't see that as often, but you know, my mother was there for us throughout our childhood, so it was great. And my dad worked; he worked hard. So that was good.
Mm-hmm. So by the end of high school, what were you thinking about your future?
Oh man, I wasn't actually. That's the whole. I didn't think a lot about my future. I guess at 17, but somewhere along the line, I started enjoying certain courses like biologies and that kind of thing, so I decided to do something in that arena. And so I actually got an associate's degree in medical laboratory science, so I became a laboratory technician performing clinical laboratory tests in hospitals, mostly hospitals then, large and small hospitals, and it was fun. I enjoyed it. I like science. I was able to have a little bit of hands-on with patients and hospitals and that kind of thing, but not too much, right? So enough for me to engage and interact with the patients, but Still some boundaries, that kind of thing. But I did that for several years, probably about 12 years. I worked in laboratories and hospitals and some private laboratories as well.
Was that still in New Jersey?
Most of it was in New Jersey. So during that time, I also started back to school to get my bachelor's part-time while I worked. And in about 1990, my husband, I'm married now, also worked for IBM, and he was transferring to Atlanta. So we moved to Atlanta in 91, I think, we came here to Atlanta. So I had to finish my bachelor's degree in a hurry because I wasn't quite finished. I actually had to challenge a course, test out of a course, because I was running out of time. So I was able to do that and get my degree, and then we moved to Atlanta.
And I'm sorry, I probably missed it, but what was your bachelor's in?
My bachelor's was in health education. Yes, it's actually health education.
Gotcha.
Non-teaching. I didn't want to teach. I just wanted to continue sort of on that science path, but get more into the education piece.
So what, if it's not teaching, what were you hoping to do?
Well, I actually went farther. So you couldn't really grow without a bachelor's degree. So that's the main reason I did go back to school, because I wanted to grow in the field I was in. So it allowed me to grow into management and supervisory positions. So that's the main reason. But I didn't want to limit myself because I knew I wasn't going to stay in medical laboratory science. I felt like I would branch out. So I got a little bit more of a broad degree, more of a general degree. Yeah. So.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So what happens when you come down to Atlanta?
Oh, wow. So working in laboratories and hospitals and private laboratories, I was familiar with entities like OSHA and CDC. So I said to myself, if I'm moving to Atlanta, I'm going to go to work for the CDC. So I'm already familiar with it. I already knew and I respected the agency, that type of thing. But it took me a year. So we moved here and I got a job in another laboratory for about a year. And then the position was advertised for CDC as a health scientist. And they were looking for people with clinical laboratory experience. And it was absolutely perfect. I applied and I was hired in 1992. So in that position, pretty much I worked in the area of CLIA, Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments. It was really about quality control and quality assurance and laboratory improvements, that kind of thing. So I wrote regulations, helped write regulations for clinical laboratories, talking about how much education one would need to perform laboratory testing, how often you should run quality control, those kinds of things. So it was very interesting. Very interesting.
who were some people who you worked with early on?
Oh, wow. So let's see. It's funny because I just ran into a couple of people today. But I worked with people like Carlin Collins, Dr. Carlin Collins. I think she's actually still here in some capacity. Tom Hearn. It was quite a few laboratorians then. Sharon Grenad. These are all health scientists or people with experience in laboratory testing. So there, a group of us were actually hired at the same time. So it's good to see them now. At 24 years later, I run into folks across CDC. That's good to see. Yeah.
So are you doing how long are you doing the lab improvement work?
So I did that for a few years. And again, I knew I always had this, I wasn't quite there yet. It was very interesting, very rewarding, but that just wasn't it yet. So I kept looking and exploring and that kind of thing. So I moved around at CDC for several years in positions, in policy and planning, those type of positions, a little bit of management official work, that kind of thing. And then during this time, I would attend lots of different sessions at CDC on various topics. And finally, that led me to psychology. So it was several years. I mean, I'm probably 15 years in at this point when I realized, okay, wow, I think I may have found my passion or something that I'm truly interested in. And during that time, CDC reorganized. We reorganized probably three times now during my career. So we were undergoing another reorganization, and I just felt like that was the opportune time for me to start select a, a school and get started on my psychology career.
Do you remember anything specific that really caught your imagination or your excitement about psychology and turned you in that direction?
So there are actually a couple of areas. One would be the injury center here at CDC. So their work on injury and suicide and that type of thing I found very interesting. And another was the work around disabilities, that kind of thing. And this substance abuse was not necessarily CDC's, but they did touch on it with some work with SAMHSA. And I still, today, really want to work in that area of substance abuse treatment or maybe research. I mean, I'm more of a clinician. I prefer sitting across from a client and helping them manage through whatever their issues are. So, yeah, those types of things.
Okay. So tell me about getting started in that direction.
Oh, man. Getting started. So I had very supportive supervision, Dr. Jay Bernhardt and then Catherine Lyon Daniels, who happens to be head of communications for CDC.
OADC.
She was my supervisor, and this was 2007. She was one of my supervisors, so I approached her and Jay Bernhardt, who was the director. She was actually the deputy director of the National Center for Health Marketing, which was sort of reorganized out. It doesn't exist now. But either way, I approached them, and they were very supportive. So I was actually able to go out on long-term training for a couple of years and focus just on schooling. So I found the school, the Georgia School of Professional Psychology here in Georgia, in Atlanta, which is pretty respected and well-known in the psychology arena. And my concern was that it would have been so difficult to do that type of program part-time. So that's why I approached them to see if I could do long-term training, and it was approved. And so in 2007, I started full-time college again, and how old was I? Probably 46 or 47 at that point. So it was more than a notion. That first semester was, oh my goodness, outrageous. Most of the students in my classes were in their late 20s, early 30s. A couple of us were over 45-ish, that kind of thing. But it was very challenging, very rigorous. And then after the first 2 years, because I was on long-term training, I was able to focus on that. But going forward after that, I had to go to school part-time and work. So it became more challenging, but I just kept doing it. A course here, well, not two or three courses here, all that kind of thing. And it also included practicums. So I was working, I was taking classes, and then I had practicums where we literally conducted therapy sessions with clients or assessments. So I was pretty busy. When I look back, I wonder how I did it. How did you do that? How did you do that? That was a 7-year journey. Actually, I just graduated 2 years ago now.
2014.
Yeah, 2014.
Wow.
Yeah, 7-year journey.
And what degree did you end up with?
Excuse me. I have a PsyD in clinical psychology.
Right. Mm-hmm. Any like experiences from practicums or anything that really stick out vividly in your memory?
Oh, man. Great experiences. So I had 3 different practicums. Generally, they lasted like 9 months, and you take coursework at the same time. And then I had a full year of internship at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Tyler, Texas. But there were so many experiences. I had such a great time. I provided services for women, men and women, and group therapy for folks with depressions or anxieties, even some psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, that kind of thing. And I spent probably a good 9 months providing services to women in a substance abuse treatment center in College Park here. That was very interesting, very rewarding. It's such a different culture. There's a huge culture of substance abuse that I learned about. And just those women's lives, how some of them, one thing it did teach me was not to get caught up in the criminal justice system, not even for something minor, because you're at the mercy of the system. No matter what is going on in your world or in your life, you're at the mercy of the system. That was very, very interesting to me. But it also taught me a lot of women with substance abuse problems also have some other kind of co-occurring disorder. Many of them were suffering depression or anxiety or PTSD, a lot of domestic violence and history of child abuse and that kind of thing. So it was very rewarding. And I still would like to get back in that arena some today if I can. So it was very rewarding. And then in Texas at my internship, I was working at a health science center, which included a hospital, a medical hospital, a mental health hospital, a brain rehab center, and also clinics, just physicians' clinics. So I actually touched all of those during that year and worked side by side with the physicians. So they're all about integrated health. It was really a team, the physicians, the nurses, the psychologist, the dietitians. It was much more of an integrated health experience, which I really, really enjoyed. I mean, I think if I had my druthers, that's probably the environment that I would be in for my career, some type of integrated health environment, because I really enjoyed that, because I've always had a love for medicine as well. So it kind of allowed me to combine those two arenas.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. Yeah, it was really rewarding.
So let's see, just to get a timeline down, what year were you in Texas?
In Texas, 2013 to 2014.
15 to 14. So you ended up in Texas, or?
Well, that is
toward
the end of my schooling. Yes, you have to do a 4-year internship, and it's competitive. So you apply and you interview, and that's where I was selected. So I had to move to Texas for a year. I took a year off without pay and moved myself to Texas to do my internship.
That sounds incredibly difficult.
Yes. I didn't know anyone. I just had to do what I had to do. So it ended up to be a great experience, though. I would do it again. I would go back if there were a reason or a need or, an opportunity.
Great.
Yeah.
Sorry, I haven't asked about this. Tell me a bit about your husband.
So that would be my ex-husband now.
Excuse me. Sorry.
That's okay. I didn't share that with you. So, and before I started school in 2007, I took a course. Everybody had to take this course in writing, which once I transferred to psychology, I didn't need that course. But either way, that professor said things will happen while you're in your doctorate program. Life will not end. So you will go through things. You may come through this with your degree. You may not. You may be able to work through things. You may not. And that's one of the things that happened to me. So somewhere along that line, things happened and I ended up divorced. So I'm divorced now. I was married 30 years, so we are integrated into both families, and it's probably going to remain that way. So yeah, it's a long time.
Gotcha.
But
okay, thank you. And can you tell me just how you, let's see, I guess the next thing would be what happens after you receive your degree?
My degree? And
yeah.
So I come back to CDC. I move back to Atlanta, get an apartment briefly, and I return to CDC here in OSAM. I work in OSAM. And my supervisor, Caroline McDonald, who is wonderful, when I came back within the first week, she said basically, so what do you want to do now? You've got all this schooling. I was actually in the OD working in policy and planning and that kind of thing. And the first thing she did was help me find somewhere where I can utilize the education that I had, that I earned. And that was actually in the height of the Ebola epidemic. So when I came back, CDC and OSAM, under the leadership pretty much of Rick Klump, was working on responder resilience and was looking for someone to stand up the well-being assessment process or program, however you want to term that. And I came back and Caroline said, well, I think I have a person for you. And I was transferred over to the Work-Life Wellness office within OSAM to really stand up that program.
What were your thoughts going in?
I thought, this is perfect. I mean, it doesn't always happen like that. Many of us, a lot of times people go back to school and they get degrees and it takes them some time to really move into their area of expertise. And I said, you know, I was so thrilled that I was able to move into that and work in the area of mental health and well-being for CDC responders. So it was perfect timing. I know. Nothing else to say. It was just perfect timing for me.
So tell me about getting started.
So, we built the plane while it was flying. So we were well into the Ebola crisis. Responders were deploying back and forth to the varying countries. And in the midst of that, probably in November 19th, of it should be 2014, I think. But we stood up the well-being assessment program. So what it consists of, essentially, anyone who was deploying anywhere related to Ebola needed to sit down and take 3 self-assessments that really assessed the responders' level of resilience, like their ability to bounce back, that type of thing. We assessed them for symptoms of anxiety and depression, and also symptoms of PTSD. And depending on their scores on those self-assessments, if they scored in a certain range, I would reach out to them and have a conversation, a well-being conversation, just to make sure they were okay and see if they had any concerns or about deploying. This is actually part of the deployment clearance process. So if they didn't complete the assessments, the clinic would not sign off on clearing them to deploy. So it's mandatory. So we're seeing all of these influx of people with these assessments that we're reviewing using this new database system that wasn't quite ready for what we needed. And we're still working actually to upgrade that system to get it where we need it. But so the individuals would deploy, and when they came back, they'd had to take the same assessments again so we could monitor them. So sometimes when they came back, people experienced some pretty traumatic events or witnessed some things that were traumatizing to them. So the scores actually varied. We are going to run analysis and statistics on all of the results and to really study them more closely. But again, when they came back, they had to take the assessments, and if they flagged, which is what we called it, they scored in a certain range, I would have another conversation with them, again, about their well-being, how they were doing. And if indeed someone was displaying symptoms that were more than moderate, maybe moderate to severe, I had the ability to refer them to our employee assistance service, employee assistance program that's staffed with licensed counselors. But that didn't happen that often. We have a very resilient group of people here at CDC. Yeah, many of them said this is the reason they came to CDC, so they were finally able to do what they came here for, which is frontline public health work. So that actually continues. Ebola has wound down, as we know. We're not deploying as many people, but they are still deploying, so we do still see people taking the assessments and that kind of thing. And I know this is not about Zika, but what has happened is we are transitioning now. Ebola has slowed down dramatically, and Zika is now picking up. So we're doing a similar process for Zika responders.
Right. So,
right. And there's some discussion of expanding the well-being assessment piece to international deployments. So we're starting those discussions now to all international deployments.
Right. Yeah. So instead of just like for one outbreak response.
Exactly.
It could be something that's continued.
Right. It can be polio. Polio's ongoing now, but they're not part of the process. So currently they don't have to take assessments. We have a huge global health unit here at CDC who are placed all over the globe. Currently they're not taking the assessments as well. So we're looking into that piece of it too.
That raises a question for me. Were all people deployed wherever taking assessments? Like if someone was deployed to Dallas, for example, would they be taking an assessment?
For Ebola?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
People who traveled, some people traveled to Geneva to give a talk on Ebola. Yes, they also were required to take the assessments. So if they went through the EOC as part of Ebola, basically, then they had to take.
So even going through the EOC and staying here in Atlanta, you would take the assessments?
Now, the folks who were detailed or working in the EOC did not take the assessments.
Okay.
Right. However, there's some discussion of that as well, because even working in the EOC can become pretty stressful over time. So we actually do have another person on our team who goes over to the EOC and does well-being visits, has talks, teaches them exercises, stress management, and just checks on them periodically, which they appreciate. So,
I'm sure they do.
Yeah. So it's actually a growing program. I'm not sure where we'll end up. We are still building that plane, but we've gotten a lot further. but yeah.
Absolutely. I have a couple questions just following up on a couple things you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
One is, can you tell me a little bit more about this new database system that you were working with and some challenges with that and how you're addressing them now?
Ooh, okay. So the system we use is called Medgate.
Okay.
Some other areas of CDC are using it as well. I know that the CDC clinic uses it. And our employee assistance program, the counselors use that system as well. So one of our biggest issues, when someone goes in to complete the assessments, that's fine. It's all recorded. We can go in and look at them and sign off on them. But we could not tell by looking at them whether that person was pre-deployment, meaning they were heading out, or whether they were post-deployment, or whether they were coming back. So we've been working with the Medgate administrators and to try and get the system to where we can recognize certain things. We also couldn't tell, now that we have a second deployment, we couldn't tell if they were deploying for Zika or Ebola in our system. Now that is tracked completely by the EOC, but in our system, we couldn't track that. So, which would make it very difficult to run any kind of analysis on the data if you cannot determine whether it was pre or post. So after a number of months in meetings with our Medgate administrators, probably just 30 days ago, we're now able to discern whether they're pre-deployed or post. So we can do that going forward. However, the issue is, we've got 6,000 and some assessments prior to this upgrade that now we've got to figure out a way to go back in and put that piece in there so we can discern whether they're pre or post or redeployment.
Is it something you think you'll be able to do?
We should be able to do it. It requires a contract amendment because the work that needs to be done on the system is outside of scope. So that's going on. And we've also had to go back and we've actually printed out a spreadsheet. They exported it. We literally had to manually go through the 6,000 assessments and then write down on this, actually send an Excel spreadsheet, and identify which are pre and post. That was a huge task. We're still doing it. We have to confirm everything. We've done it once. Now we're going again so we can confirm what we did manually. And then the Medgate administrators will somehow upload that into the system.
Is this so?
It's been a huge challenge.
I can only imagine.
For us. Yeah.
Were people taking these assessments online or were they on paper?
They're online. They're also in that Medgate system. So essentially, okay, they go in the front end of the Medgate system and we go in the back end and then review them and approve them and then call and talk to them if we need to, that kind of thing. Yes. So they would get notice to complete the assessments as part of their pre-deployment checklist. There's a checklist that goes out to everyone before they deploy, and it would be listed as one of the things that they need to do to go in and complete the assessments.
So what was kind of the range of responses that you got from people when you called them to say, hey, you've been flagged by our system? Mm-hmm. And what do you say?
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, too. It varied really from person to person. Overall, everybody's appreciative. Many people do have anxiety, and they appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Not enough to prevent them from deploying, but they just had the opportunity to sort of verbalize any concerns. For example, say if you had a history of panic disorder, is this deployment going to aggravate or exacerbate your panic? So just in talking to you, I can kind of tell what's going on with you and to what level and whether or not we need to follow up on things. So we were able to do that. But we asked questions about their coping skills. How do you self-soothe? What do to self-soothe? So whether it's adaptive or non-adaptive, drinking is not necessarily adaptive. Most people exercise, read books. We asked about support networks, family members who are generally part of their support network, those kinds of things. Is this your first deployment? If they were experienced deployers, it's less likely that they would have an issue. We asked about insight. Some people have poor insight, others have good insight, meaning they recognize when they're starting to become overwhelmed, need to take a break. Others just keep going and going until it's over the top and it can't function. So we ask those kind of questions, talk about those kind of things, and then just open it up and let them know, ask them if there's anything that they would like to discuss or any concerns. A lot of people are concerned about their work. Is it going to sit there until I get back? And it happens. Unfortunately, sometimes people's work will sit there until they get back, and that in and of itself causes some anxiety. Some are hesitant about going, but go because they don't want to disappoint their supervisors. So you have that discussion. Okay, let's weigh that out. Right? What's important here? And if you're going, if you feel like you're being pushed to go, are you going to be as effective? Are you going to function at the level you need to? Those kind of things. So it's all over the place. And actually, one of the assessments, it's called the CD Risk. It was 25 questions, and that's the one that assesses your ability to your resilience, your ability to bounce back. That had a couple of questions on it that gave our scientists, our deployers, angst. It had a question, for example, that asked about making decisions on a hunch without knowing why. So we are a agency full of scientists. We don't make decisions on a hunch. Had a question about fate. A lot of concerns on why are you asking me about religion? And our response was the assessment was validated on various populations. We didn't make it up. We didn't select the questions. We just made sure we picked one that was statistically sound and validated on varying populations. But fate and religion are basically associated with resilience. So that's probably why the question is there. But we do listen to our employees. We do listen to the people we talk to. And we also noticed that the results were trending a little bit lower because of those questions. And so we did research and come up with another assessment. Actually, it's the same assessment, but it's just a 10-question version. And in a 10-question version, those three questions are removed. So, that was huge because we were getting several comments about those questions. So, and some people were flagging because of those questions, because they would say zero, not at all. So that would make their score lower and they would flag. So we were getting false positives. So yeah, we made a change.
Yeah, yeah. Rick Klomp mentioned a little bit about that too. Mm-hmm. And a question I had, I don't think I thought to ask him, but mm-hmm. now that you bring it back up, mm-hmm. What does it mean for a study to be, or a set of questions to be validated? Mm-hmm. You don't have to go in depth or anything.
No, that's okay. Yes, you definitely want to use an assessment that has been validated. And what that means is that there have been studies. So actually, we took the results from the CD-RIS 25 and had our biostatistician, Melissa is her name, great person, run and to perform data analysis on the CD-RIS25 so we could actually come up with our therapeutic range, if you will, for the CD-RIS10. So this is actually huge because the CD-RIS10 is based on our population. So we didn't go out and look at other populations where that were studied and given this assessment. This is actually, our results are based on CDC employees. So, I mean, that's a gold standard. You can't get it.
Yeah, tailored to the population.
Exactly. We can't get any better than that. So.
Gotcha. Oh boy, I have a range of things I'm interested in. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Good? Okay. I'm wondering about, like, you mentioned that with the databases. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm kind of going backwards here. But
that's okay.
That you're in the process, maybe you've done some of this already, but of mm-hmm. analyzing the results.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of questions do you ask of the data that you've been put, that's been put in there, and
mm-hmm.
what kind of questions can you answer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our goal is, we're just now starting the data analysis process. And what our goal is really, first of all, to see, and we already know this, but whether this process is useful, whether there's utility for just doing this entire process. And so we're looking at questions. We want to get a sense of the ranges of results for our employees. We want to look at which questions trend higher or trend lower, those kinds of things. We want to look at how many folks endorse symptoms of PTSD, and we don't have many. So for example, we can look at the individual questions on each assessment and see maybe that can help us learn where to focus in our trainings. So if everybody's struggling, or many people are struggling with the question, and I noticed this question about humor. So there's a question on the CD-RIS that talks about, I can find humor in most situations. Not everybody can do that. So, and I don't mean funny ha-ha, but sometimes we have to lighten up a little bit if we can try and get through things. And a lot of people struggle with that. They're very focused, very serious, and that can be detrimental in some ways. So we can actually pinpoint questions and look for areas to focus on with our employees. But we also want to look at, I mean, if we have a number of people, for example, endorsing depression symptoms on the Kessler 10, maybe we want to use another assessment and that breaks out the depression symptoms more, so we're capturing more about that. So, yeah, there are a lot of different areas for us to look at. And really, it's about process improvement. So we're really going to delve in and study the numbers and see what we can do. Do we need to change assessments? Should we offer them more often? Are we offering them too often currently? You know, that kind of thing. Just a lot to look at in that area.
So are part of the assessments kind of people evaluating the assessment? Is that how you're able to pull data to analyze what you're doing? Or how... Sorry, that's not a very clear question.
Oh, no, that's okay. No, analyzing the actual questions to see how people respond to them.
Right.
So.
But I'm thinking about mm-hmm. analyzing the efficacy of the assessments.
Mm-hmm.
Were there processes where you asked responders to directly comment on their experience with the assessments?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we are going to do that. That's another piece of our evaluation. But we haven't gotten to that component yet. So we do intend to do that, evaluate the evaluations,
right.
Evaluate the assessments. We do get comments, but we haven't done it formally yet. And we will do that too. We actually just brought an ORISE fellow on board who will focus on our evaluation piece with us. So that will be her main focus, to help us evaluate the process. Top to bottom and see where we need to make improvements. And that includes reaching out to those who have completed the assessments to get their thoughts. So we will do that.
Gotcha.
Absolutely.
So I know you must have worked pretty closely with Rick Klomp mm-hmm. and with probably Lori Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yep.
And Lisa, maybe to some extent.
Lisa McDaniel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about working with them or any other people who you spent time with? You mentioned Melissa, the biostatistician.
Right. I was lucky enough to really become part of a good group. I mean, Rick was already there. He was very welcoming. He's clearly the expert. He's been working on resilience for a number of years now, so he's clearly the expert. He's definitely our go-to person. But he's very welcoming and very receptive of others coming into his arena, so to speak. He's very supportive of each of us, actually, in the resilience group. And while he's very busy generally teaching, training others in the area of resilience, he's always available to us as needed. He's not hands-on with the assessment piece, per se, but he has a great grasp, obviously, of what's going on and can explain and talk about it with anybody at any level. But luckily, he doesn't have to go in the system and press the buttons and the keys like I do. So he doesn't have to do that. Lori's great. Lori takes care of another piece of the resilience process, where she offers everyone returning from deployment an opportunity to sit and talk with her about their experience. It might be some mental well-being questions in there, but a lot of it's about the process, what they experienced when they were over there. So she does that. And she also backs me up. So when I'm not able to go into Medgate, or if I'm out of the office and we need to talk to someone before they deploy, Lori does that for me as well. She does a great job at that. And Lisa does too. Lisa also backs me up. So I have two backups, primarily because somebody has to be available to go in the system. Oftentimes we'll get calls from the CDC clinic, hey, this person is deploying tomorrow. Can you take a look? Let us know. So someone has to be available all the time, every day. And we have had instances where we had people deploying over the weekend. And luckily for me, Lori Jones is Commissioned Corps, so she's available 24/7. So they called her if it was on the weekend. But we each have a primary role, and we back each other up otherwise. And we'll bounce questions and thoughts off of each other, because each of us have had well-being conversations. That's the conversations we hold with deployers who have flagged results. And we also do the same when it comes to process improvement. How can we make this process better, more efficient, more effective, and that kind of thing. So all three of us, Lori, Lisa, and myself, are all licensed professionals. So it makes it very easy to actually back each other up, because you really need someone with that kind of training who can sit down and talk to you or whomever and focus on those nuances, right? Get a sense of how you're presenting, the words you use, the way you act, sit, you know, whether you're fidgeting or whether you're very calm, and that kind of thing. So you're trained to pick up on those nuances. So it's good that we have each other. Rick, too, as you know, is a licensed professional. So it's a good group.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you really focus quite a bit on little details that tell you something.
Absolutely. Yes. So just when people talk, they tell you a lot about themselves by what they share, and then what they may emphasize or what they may not emphasize, and just in how they present or their affect. So whether they're saying, I'm fine, I'm doing well, but they have tears in their eyes, or they're saying nothing's wrong, or they have tears in their eyes, or they're smiling and laughing when they're talking about something traumatic. They just seen, and they're smiling and giggling. And so that's kind of incongruent. There's an issue there. So we kind of talk through it and see what's really going on.
Right.
You can get a good sense of how someone's, I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, we could do clinical interviews, which should take about an hour. We don't talk to someone for an hour, unless it's absolutely necessary. But if we did a full clinical interview, we could obviously learn a lot more about the person. We talk to them enough to get a sense of their well-being and their functioning and whether or not we need to refer them. And then if there is an issue, we will collaborate with the clinic. So I've done that on several occasions, collaborate with the clinic about what I found during a conversation. And together we'll make a determination, well, should we approve this person? Should we put any stipulations on it? Those kinds of things. We've had a couple of people where we had some question or some concern, but it wasn't enough to not approve them to deploy. But what we did instead was conduct a well-being visit via phone halfway through their deployment. So we will follow up on people during deployment if necessary.
When you mentioned the clinic, is that the employee assistance program or is that something different?
No, the occupational health clinic is the CDC's medical clinic. That's where the staff go to get their vaccines, and they get a medical checkup before they deploy. And I'm not certain what that entails. I mean, that's their expertise. But part of that clinic process is the assessments. So they have to take the assessments as well, and that also informs the clinic's decision. So if we have concerns, we talk to the clinicians over there, and together we, or if they have concerns, they saw someone who maybe didn't take the assessments yet, but they've seen them and they have concerns, they may contact us and say, what do you think about this?
Were you doing the mid-deployment assessments with people?
No. So we don't do mid-deployment assessments currently, but we don't know. That might happen for long-term people who are deployed long-term. That's going to be part of the discussion we're looking at to expand the entire process.
Okay.
But currently we don't do mid-term. We do pre and post.
Pre and post. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple individuals who were flagged and it was decided to assess
them?
Yeah,
people also, I mean, you can flag and still deploy. And that's what our conversation is. If we have the conversations and we don't have very minimal or no concerns.
Of course.
Then we also put a note. So this is all recorded. It's part of the medical record. So anyone we speak with, we enter a clinical note in the Medgate system. So that's recorded in their medical record. But if they flagged and we had some concerns, but not enough, they don't have to take the assessments again during deployment, but we will call them.
Right.
Have a conversation with them.
Right.
Deployment.
I think I misunderstood something then. Mm-hmm. I thought that there were a couple individuals who were flagged and then were followed up mid deployment. Maybe not by you, but by the clinic or somebody else.
Well, that's possible. I wouldn't be aware if the clinic followed up, but
sorry.
I know we have followed up on a few people.
Mid deployment. Oh, you have?
Yes.
Okay.
We have. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And was that you or Rick or Lori?
Whoever's available.
Yeah.
And what we try to do, if you establish a relationship with someone and they need a follow up, we try to have the same person follow up. So you build that rapport. So if I saw them and it was mid deployment, then I would reach out to them mid deployment.
What kinds of questions do you ask them, and like that might be different or the same?
Well, they are actually the same. For example, you may have someone with a diagnosis of PTSD. So they flag, but they're not so symptomatic that they can't function. So when you call them, you'll just see how they're doing. Are you practicing self-care? Are you monitoring yourself? How is your anxiety level? You know, just get them to talk to you about how things are going. Are you getting the rest? Sometimes when they deploy, they work 21 days straight without, and so are you getting the rest? Are you talking to your supervisor, letting them know that you're starting to feel more and more anxious or whatever? Just a pretty in-depth conversation about their well-being, making sure that they're okay, and giving them the resources so they can actually call our EAP while they're there. They can actually call the Federal Occupational Health Office 24/7. They have licensed professionals on staff all the time. So we make sure they have the resources. They know what resources we have for them as well. Yeah.
Okay. One thing that brings to mind is one thing that Rick really emphasized in my interview with him, I think last week, was a lot of care to make sure that people don't feel put upon when they're asked. When they're flagged and they're asked more questions, right? Like, because you don't want to freak someone out and get in their way. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yep, it's a little bit of finessing. So when you do contact somebody, and then they are concerned, and when they, I'll send a calendar invite, and it says that, you know, I would like to speak to you about the assessments that you completed. And then I always say, I look forward to talking with you, you know, that kind of thing, to soften it up. And then when we meet, it's very conversational, even though I'm looking to pick up certain things. It's very conversational. How are you? How are you doing? Is this your first deployment? And if they have experience, oh, tell me about some of your experiences with overseas assignments. But most people don't mind. They don't feel like you're prying. I mean, I don't say, do you have a history of suicide? Are you taking any medication? Now, if they want to tell me they're taking medication, that's fine. We'll have that discussion. But because that is part of the medical appointment, I don't need to ask that, basically. But if they share it, we'll talk about it, that kind of thing. But I don't make it very clinical. So since I make it conversational, and then I assure them, you know, it is confidential. I do have to put a note in the system because it's part of your medical record. One or two people had a concern about that because, and they were Commissioned Corps, and they wanted to know if it would impact their promotions. I said, I don't see any glaring concerns. It's not going to impact anything. But there are some of that. But most people appreciate it. I mean, oftentimes you're reminding them to take care of themselves because they're so busy taking care of others. A lot of the physicians that I spoke with, great at taking care of others. Many, I mean, they're good at taking care of themselves, but not always. So it was just a reminder, take care of you as well.
Right.
So, and we'll talk about different coping strategies, different ways to self-soothe. And I learned from them as well. I mean, sometimes they teach me. They teach me things. So.
What are some things that you learned?
So some of the meditation strategies that some of the folks, some of them use, or even just like I said, a lot of people read, a lot of people exercise, many meditate. But it was like, I'm sorry, my memory is getting me. But one person shared it was a technique that she and her loved one used when they contacted each other. It was just a little nuance in their communications that was hugely helpful for them. Just those kinds. So you learn from each other. Yeah. And a lot of the stress is actually, like I think I mentioned, work-related, particularly when it was the end of the year and it was time to go through evaluations. It's a lot of work for people to go through those, to prepare them, to meet with staff. And you add that on top of your duties related to Ebola, it becomes so pretty stressful. So it varied by the time of year as well.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the distinction that you're kind of drawing between like the clinical side of things, the medical side of things, mm-hmm. and then what you're doing, which mm-hmm. you would characterize that as resiliency or as...
Right. Yeah, we categorize it as resilience. And it's kind of gray. It's not, we don't want people to think that we're providing some sort of therapy because we're not. But it's still clinical. I mean, it's we are putting a note in the system. So it still has a clinical component. But it's more like a modified clinical interview or I lost my term. Come on, help me with this. Triage. It's almost
triage.
Like a triage.
Sure.
Right.
That makes sense.
Right.
Here, you might need this. Here are the resources for that.
Right, right. And if we recognize something or we hear something or they express some concerns, then we will, you know, we'll take care of that. We'll handle it. We'll follow up for them.
Right.
But, yeah, so it's just, you know, we try not to make it clinical because that's not what people are signing up for.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Question out of left field now. You mentioned that... It was really nice to have like Lori and Lisa and Rick to bounce ideas off of.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think and give me a specific instance in which that was really helpful for you, having that community of people to?
Mm-hmm. So this is it may be down in the weeds because you know, we're the ones that are really hands on, so we're the ones that look at the assessments and that kind of thing. So we were having some issue with duplication of people on, for example, how should we handle this? Because we still want to keep it confidential. If this person is flagged and they also say, yes, I want to talk to Lori, who would be the best person to handle that? Should it be me more? Because it's a little bit more clinical, the assessments, that kind of thing. Or should it be Lori with the more general conversation about process? but then she can also glean how someone is doing because of her training. So something like that. There are several what may appear to be small items that we talk about, but they actually have a huge impact. I mean, if you're overwhelming someone, you're talking to them 2 and 3 times, they're not going to want to come back and talk to you at all. So figure out a way to give them what they need, get the results of the assessment, have a conversation with them once, and then allow them to go do what they're deployed to do, and right. That kind of thing. So some things like that. A lot of database issues that we had to work through. Even signing notes. I mean, we had issues with signing clinical notes. I had to make some changes in the system, so that kind of thing. We still have a glitch. It looks like if I sign a note and Lori goes in and signs a note on that same person, my note somehow disappears. I mean, we still have a few glitches that we have to work out. One of the other things we do is just bounce off of each other how we handle our conversations with people. So we don't ask exactly the same questions, but we get the same information. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We want to get the same information, but you have that sort of leeway to be the clinician that you are to get that information.
So what would cause you to phrase something in a specific way rather than another? Like the context, the like personality?
Right, yeah. So if someone's a little bit more defensive, you might want to ask them about, so how do you self-soothe a little bit differently? Or you might even start with the lead-in. Well, when I'm stressed or anxious, here are some of the things I do. I'd be curious to hear what you do. You know, what do you do to kind of, instead of just more of a direct question? On the K-10 assessment, you scored a 4 on this, which makes it look like you have a little bit of anxiety. What's going on with that? And how do you, right? One is more clinical.
Right.
One is more conversational.
Right.
So just, trying to do that in a way that doesn't appear clinical.
And I get the sense that that's something that you really appreciate, that it's something you really respect, and it's up your alley. Is that right? Or is that
absolutely? Yeah, it is up my alley. And we're actually trained. I mean, you're trained to interview people for various reasons, and you have to learn different techniques to do that. Because I can say the same sentence to you, and you perceive it completely different than if I said those same words to somebody else. So you have to learn. I mean, it's hard to learn your person in 20 minutes. However, you can kind of get a sense of what your person might look like just from their results. And I don't mean physically. I mean present like, right? So you can almost get a sense of that just from looking at the results. So you kind of know what to expect.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I know that you're probably limited in what all you can tell me because of confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
But can you give me just in broad strokes some of the things you heard back from, let's start with pre-deployment like assessments?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
In broad strokes. So I'm kind of, I'm mixing two things here, my assessments and Lori's post briefings with people, because we've actually pulled together themes that are non-identifiable. So just themes that people tend to talk about when they come back, and that involves before they go. So some of the things that people talk about are not knowing exactly what their role is going to be until they get there, which you can imagine can cause some anxiety. What am I going to do? Is it going to be in my area of expertise? You know, that kind of thing. So that kind of question was, sometimes it's, I wasn't picked up from the airport. There was no one there to get me. I'm here in this country and I don't know anybody, and things like that. Sometimes it's actual things they saw, like sick children or death and dying, you know, sometimes those kind of things. And it's really across the gamut. But if it's process related things, like I didn't know what I was going to do, there are people now who have made improvements based on a lot of those comments. So trying to get people that information as soon as possible is huge, because it reduces the stress and anxiety level.
Who would you give that information to?
It actually goes to the EOC, the DRMU, the Mitigation Unit.
Deployment Risk Mitigation Unit.
Risk Mitigation Unit, you're right. Under Jeff Nimhauser. They really take those comments, and if there's a way to make process improvements, and then you notice you do hear the same comments kind of over and over again, and when you do that, then obviously you do need to make some kind of change. But it's a lot of that. It's a lot of concern. I think I mentioned about the work. Is my work going to sit while I'm gone? Well, my work is sitting while I'm gone, so I'm stressed out. And for the post, so we look a lot at reintegration. So when they come back from deployment, how long does it take them to really get back into their routine with their family, with their friends, with their work, that kind of thing. So a lot of conversation, maybe, and concerns around that area too, just reintegrating. Early on, as you can imagine, it was a huge piece around stigma when they came back. People not wanting to be around them, people saying keep your children home from school, don't come to a family event. And I think CDC did an awesome job of really addressing that piece of it, but that was huge.
This is a wild question. Were you within the space in which you worked? Was that a lane in which you could counter the stigma, or was that not even part of what you were doing, and so that wasn't? Or
that was a lane where you may not counter it, but you help someone process through it.
Right.
Like how they're feeling, how it impacts them, how they can navigate through it, even though they're still subjected to it. So that would be, that's a little bit more clinical, but that would be our lane.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. So absolutely.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, do you have any last things that you'd like to talk about? Not just from the Ebola response, but from your life, career?
I don't know. You know, I guess I would say, first of all, I mean, I feel like I've been blessed. I never thought I'd be at CDC for 24 years. So prior to coming to CDC, working in different labs and laboratory science, it's a career where people change employments often. So I did a lot of that when I was younger. And then I came here. But and the good thing about CDC is, though, you can change areas within CDC and still be a CDC employee. So there's so much opportunity within. You don't necessarily have to leave the agency to get experience and your expertise, that kind of thing. So that really made the difference for me. That's probably why I'll retire from CDC more than likely. But it's just been, I guess, it's just been wonderful that I was just able to progress in my career at my pace in the areas that I wanted to, you know, where my interests were, and then have supportive people around me, supervisors and colleagues, right, that allowed me to do that, right, or supported me in that process. And I think that's what's occurring even with resilience, so with Rick. So just that opportunity to work in a field that I'm passionate about. And then I would mention, too, that I also have a practice part-time. I know this is not CDC related.
No, that's good.
But I practice part-time on the outside. So one day a week, I see clients. So that allows me the really clinical, if you will, the hardcore clinical piece. That kind of, it helps me because that's where my passion is, the clinical piece. So that sustains me enough to where, you know, my work at CDC is very rewarding, but it's not. Yeah, the clinical piece that I want. So that kind of helps me balance it. I still have my hand in it enough for now until I retire, and then I'll likely get much, much more involved in the clinical side of the house. So,
yeah. And in the clinical, is that where you're able to, I don't know if now, but sometime in the future, kind of scratch that itch for substance abuse counseling?
Yep. I may do some of that individually. Client per client if necessary, but I'm also going to look for opportunities maybe for some group, maybe get involved in a substance abuse program. My passion is working with adolescent girls and women, so I'll find some activities in that arena. Going forward, actually, I'll probably do some of that now. So,
can you, you don't have to go in depth, but can you tell me briefly about that and your interest in that?
I think it comes from my work as at my practicum in the substance abuse program, which was actually, it was a milieu, and it's a 5-day-a-week program. So those women were there from 8 to 3:30, 5 days a week, and you were intimately involved in their well-being. So there's substance abuse treatment. There are actually processes, actual interventions that we would do, in addition to treating their depressions and their PTSDs. And just watching these women evolve back to functioning, thriving adults is huge, because some of the stories are just ridiculously daunting. Some of them have been through huge issues throughout their lives, but yet, talk about resilience, but yet they continue to make the effort to try and come out of that and have as normal of a life as possible. So just kind of watching that, people who are really fighting for their lives and every way they can is just something that I don't know, it's just so rewarding.
Sounds inspiring.
To watch that process happen. And then, of course, teenage girls. I just enjoy working with young brains. I mean, they're still, a lot of them have some issues, but they listen to every word. Even though you might not think they're listening to you, and they may squirm and make faces and roll their eyes, they actually listen and appreciate the attention, and they listen to every word that you say. And they come back. Even when you do something that makes them angry, like some things you have to share by law with parents and that kind of thing, even when you do that, they still come back, because they just appreciate that attention and that someone cares about them and that someone is advocating for them. So I enjoy that. So.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to mention this, but I just heard you mention the word retire a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you're thinking about for like the midterm, maybe, and then spending more time in your practice? Mm-hmm. Or?
Right. I think I have about 4.5 more years, actually, till that's what the system tells me, until I can retire. So my goal is now to just get myself where I need to be financially. So if I choose to retire and focus strictly on clinical psychology work, I can do that. So for me, when I do retire and focus on that, I don't want to be overwhelmed. I don't want to work 40, 60 hours a week. I have to get myself at a place where clearly I can afford to do that. But I may or may not retire. It really depends on where I am here in my career. So we'll see how that happens. Well, what happens with that?
Okay.
Actually, the whole mental health arena is growing in focus. Even here at CDC, we're looking at areas for mental health where we should be involved, where we should increase the research, what should our strategy be around mental health. So who knows? Maybe more opportunity even here at CDC. Yeah. But for now, for me, resilience.
Beautiful.
I'm pleased.
Well, anything that we might have missed, or any last thoughts or reflections?
I don't think so. I guess I really just appreciate the opportunity to do this. I don't know. I had no idea, obviously, that this was happening, but Rick shared it with me, so I really appreciate being part of it.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing about your experiences. It's an honor.
Thank you. Yeah. And it is, I didn't deploy. So usually you hear from people and their experiences when they deployed, which is, right, awesome. But so now I guess, I don't know, I think I downplayed my role, so to speak. So in talking to you, it just helps me realize how important it is, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
The work that we're doing.
And now more than ever, when you're mm-hmm. talking about making the things that you did mm-hmm. Part of the system, mm-hmm. like, it's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. It is. And that's my takeaway today. It's huge.
Right. All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Crystal.
Thank you.